Succession number 21095, reel 16.
Hella Pick, reel 16.
Right, so I told the Guardian, I was the first to tell the Guardian of the invasion of Czechoslovakia at the time, because obviously a few minutes later all the other wire services had it too, but I was just seconds ahead of other people. And the Guardian immediately said, well, you know, you've got to go to, you know, instantly, you know, you obviously you must go ahead, fly to Prague. So off we went the next morning to fly to Vienna, because there were no direct flights into Prague anymore. And got to Vienna, impossible to get into Prague anymore. I mean, the place was shut down. So what I did, amongst other things, was to go to the border near Bratislava and watch the refugees coming out. Then there were various prominent Czechs who appeared, you know, we interviewed. I think at the time I was not as aware as I became later on that the Austrians had in fact, that is Kurt Waldheim, who was foreign minister of Austria at that moment, had in fact issued instructions to the Austrian ambassador in Prague that he, telling him that he must not give any visas to Czechs, because they were afraid, as Waldheim told me afterwards, which I don't really believe, that, I mean, they had evidence, they thought that the Russians would try to infiltrate spies into Austria and so on and so forth. So anyway, after the Austrian ambassador in Prague, who was the future president of Austria, called Rudolf Kirchschläger, in fact refused to obey orders and did issue visas. But anyway, that's by the by, because in fact Austria did allow a lot of Czechs came in 68. Anyhow, there we were, a lot of journalists trying to cover the invasion of Czechoslovakia from outside Czechoslovakia. We then decided to move on, to a lot of us, to Belgrade, where the Czech foreign minister, I mean, Dubček's foreign minister and various other senior politicians had fled. And we interviewed them there. And then the rumor started spreading that Romania was next on the Soviet list, and that Romania was about to be invaded. So quite a lot of us set off by train, on the night train from Belgrade to Bucharest. And none of us had visas. And at that time, you may remember, Ceausescu was considered to be one of the free spirits of the communist bloc, heaven help us all. And they had no visa requirements for tourists, but they did have visa requirements for people who came to work. And of course, we were all carrying typewriters in those days. And though the border guards, you know, obviously must have known who we were all allowed in. And the American journalists all made for the hotels with the best views of the great boulevards, where they assumed the tanks would soon come rolling in. And the rest of us had to make do with sort of lesser lesser rooms, not the ones facing the big roads. And there was one hotel that had an indoor swimming pool, and you know, we all come, you know, we none of us had anything much to do, because there was no one to interview, because the Romanians were not being allowing themselves to be interviewed. We were just waiting for this invasion to come. And after about the third or fourth day of being there, the Romanians did sort of try and make us go off and see various things, you know, show places of theirs, but very few people wanted to leave Bucharest, and I mean, local officials were certainly not being made available. And we were all sitting there one evening in the bar, sort of waiting for something to happen, when one of our colleagues, Arno de Borggraaf, who was a very senior correspondent of Newsweek magazine, came in looking very portentous and saying, just been speaking to the Romanian foreign minister, and he tells me that everything is going to be all right. And we all look up, and up speaks a very young journalist working for Time magazine, and says, you know, this is rather curious because the Romanian foreign minister is in New York. So that was a great put down for Arno. But anyway, about 24 hours later, President Johnson announced on the radio or on television in America that he had had assurances from the Soviet Union that there would be no invasion of Romania, as indeed there was not. And we all departed again, but it's been an amazing collection of people because most newspapers had run out of correspondence. So, you know, they had some people in Belgrade and some in Vienna, and some were still stuck in Prague and couldn't get out. And there were a number of sports commentators from the papers that sent in because they hadn't got anybody else to send. I mean, we were a very curious collection of people. But that was my sort of experience of 1968, but I never did get to Prague at that time because it was just impossible to get in. And then, and while I was in Geneva doing European integration, I also went off to Yugoslavia a few times to party congresses, and you know, where there were great reunions with all my lovely generals that I got to know who were part of these party congresses and so on. And, you know, it all seemed, I mean, you know, it was such a pleasure to get to Belgrade in those days because it was a relaxed place. And also, I had got to know one journalist, because there was always a problem of where do you stay when you go to these East European capitals. And there was a hotel in Belgrade called the Hotel Moskva, which was right in the center of the town. And this one correspondent that I'd met always stayed there, and it was always difficult to get into that because it was a smallish hotel, and you had to. This was very much a self-management hotel. You had to be approved by the staff. If they were happy to have you there, that's fine. But on the whole, this was intended for visiting business people, and Fitzroy McLean always stayed there and so on. And anyway, they approved of me. And in that hotel, all the rooms were sort of duplexes. You had a little sitting room downstairs, and then you went up a spindly staircase, and you had a platform with a bed and the bathroom. And you know, it was always great fun. It was right in the middle of the town. And you met a lot of people in the lobby. And I was so well in with them that when, I mean, this is really jumping miles ahead, but after Tito's death, during the funeral, all the hotels in central Belgrade were told to clear it for the visiting dignitaries who were coming in for the funeral. And a couple of us went to the self-management team in the Hotel Moscow and said, we don't want to leave the Hotel Moscow, we want to stay here. And they said, you can. You just have to have smaller rooms, but you can stay with us. We're not going to throw you out. And they didn't. So that was self-management at its best, that hotel.
So you covered the funeral, did you, Hella?
Yes. I mean, not only that. I mean, again, you know, this was a little bit like going to Romania and waiting for the Soviet invasion. A lot of papers sent their people to Belgrade at least a month before Tito died because it was assumed that Tito was dying. And everybody felt they had to be there because that was the moment when Yugoslavia would disintegrate. And I remember I flew into Belgrade together with Peter Jennings, who was then the chief London correspondent of ABC television and who is now their anchor on their nightly news. And that was the beginning of a really very close friendship. And and then there were some other journalist friends of who came in from Moscow, the Time bureau chief, and who came in with lots of caviar. And I remember we used to, you know, sit in each other's rooms at night and always phone downstairs for toast. And we had our vodka and our caviar, and we had a wonderful time. And then, you know, there was relatively little to do in the daytime. So I remember one day we went off to a village near Belgrade where there was a whole school of naive painters. And we went from studio to studio and bought these paintings. And all of us, we still have paintings that we bought then. So that was a sort of sidebar to waiting for Tito to die. And then the American ambassador at the time was Larry Eagleburger. And, you know, we obviously went to sit at his feet to hear what he had to say. And I still have the notebook with the notes of what he said. And he said over and over again, you know, Tito has built such a strong country. It will never disintegrate. And he's leaving behind a constitution that will work. And do not worry, the country is not going to disintegrate. The Russians are not going to seize it. You know, all will be well. And so, you know, we didn't have to worry, and there was really no need to wait for Tito's death, because nothing much was going to happen anyhow. So, strange. But to go back to my time in Geneva, because, yes, I said I went off to Yugoslavia quite a few times from there, but also 68, as you remember, was a country where it was a time, a year of many events. And it was also the beginning of the Vietnam peace talks and, of course, of the French 68, Revolution of 68. And the Guardian sent me to Paris to cover the Vietnam peace talks. And they coincided, of course, with the beginning of the Revolution of 68 in Paris. And as it happened, the weekend before France came to a standstill, and also happened to be the weekend before the Vietnam talks had their official opening, I'd been invited to the Guardian's Paris correspondent's cottage in the country, and together with the correspondent of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, who was a friend from Washington, and we rented one of those really small Fiats, you know, the ones where you can hardly fit in to sit in them, and drove out to the country. And as we were driving back, we were listening to the car radio, and it was perfectly obvious that, you know, strikes were about to start in a major way. And we decided we'd hold on to this car, little car, and we filled it with petrol. And I was staying in a Left Bank hotel. He was staying in the Bristol, being a rich paper, he was staying at the Bristol on the right bank, just behind the Champs-Élysées. And between us, we owned this car for the duration of the revolution. And we managed to fill it up once at OECD. We had friends who allowed us to use their pumps to fill it up. And so we had this extraordinary experience of driving through the empty streets of Paris the whole time. And we drove out, you know, to the strikers at the Peugeot works and all sorts of things, because even though I was primarily concerned with the Vietnam talks, you know, there was still time to do things on the strikes as well. And it was a really interesting time. And of course, the Vietnam talks themselves, the beginning of it, was fascinating. And again, the little vignette. Quite early on the first or second day of the talks, I had arranged an interview with Admiral Harriman, who was the chief American negotiator. And he was headquartered, I think it was in the Crillon Hotel. And while we were waiting, a couple of workmen appeared and said, that they had instructions, there was something wrong with the heating arrangements in the ambassador's office. They had instructions to go in and deal with it. And they were not let in, but it was perfectly obvious that they were not workmen dealing with anything to do with the heating. But it was quite amusing to witness that little scene. But then the peace talks were, of course, absolutely fascinating to follow in their early stages. And to meet the various delegations, the North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese, just in order to sort of keep up with the Vietnamese, we went to eat in various Vietnamese restaurants, and but always tried to find out whether they were North Vietnamese or South Vietnamese. And I don't know, there was a lot of work, but it was such an exciting time to be in Paris. And it was really quite exhilarating. And then I remember one day we went to the Beaux-Arts, where the students were doing all these wonderful posters about the revolution, which were up on the which they then pasted up on street walls, and we asked if we could buy some of them, and the students said, were furious and said, you know, this is not a commercial enterprise. This is for a cause, and they're not available for you. So on the last day before it all ended, my friend from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and I, we walked around Paris. It was raining, and we peeled off posters. And I still have three or four of these, and they're all framed in my flat. And I'm sure they must be valuable now because, you know, they were sort of one-off pieces. And
How big was that event, you know, the revolution of 68 in
huge.
France?
I mean, you know, there were nightly huge demonstrations, day and night after night, and of course I being on the left bank, you know, there was not a night without the sirens going and without the students streaming down in Saint-Germain-des-Prés and everything. And I had actually talking about propaganda, the Paris editor of Les Preuves, François Bondy, Les Preuves was one of the magazines financed by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was the CIA. He had a flat high on the top floor of a building from which you had near the Île Saint-Louis, where you had a view of the left bank on the one side and of the right bank and the Île Saint-Louis on the other. And we went up there several times and you know, watched the demonstrations below. But no, it was massive and it was huge and it was very inspiring. You know, and we went to the Académie Française and listened to the speeches being made in there. And you know, you really felt that this was a new world and it was changing.
And what were the demands? What was it all about?
It was about greater freedoms, about democracy. About an end to the Cold War, about peace, and about youth, an end to dictatorship, an end in France, of course, an end to Gaullism. And then, of course, on the last day, when, you know, suddenly everything came back to, when suddenly, you know, I remember we said, you know, just before the strikes were over and the petrol was going to come back and the cars were going to come back, if only we could pour cement over all of this and just leave it like this for all eternity. I mean, you know, if you can imagine Paris without cars and without buses. I mean, it was just the buildings. It was just magical. It's something that you're never going to see again, and you know it's hard to recall now. But it really was very, very exciting. And of course we couldn't get out, you see, because I mean there were no flights, no railways, nothing. No, it was you really felt, you know, there is a new, brave new world out there, and then it didn't happen. And then, of course, de Gaulle made his dramatic return, and it was all over. I remember on the day that he came back, friends of mine who had been in the south of France and had somehow got to Paris and were staying at the Crillon, and they had a rooms overlooking the Place de la Concorde. And, you know, we saw this, I watched the great rally when de Gaulle came back, and, you know, that was the end of it. And by that time, the Vietnam talks had got out of their first bloom, the first excitement had worn off. It was clear this was going to be a long, drawn-out and probably quite useless farce. And, you know, we all left. But while it lasted, it was great. And so and then I went back to Geneva again. And then, I suppose, in about 1970, 71, the paper asked me to come back to London. And the editor offered me Washington and said, you know, you're going to have Washington now. And I didn't want to go back to Washington, God knows why. And I said, no, thank you. And then I told various people about this, and they said, you know, you're just crazy. And I went back to Alistair Hetherington, and, you know, just these things would not happen with today's Guardian. I tell you that. Wouldn't have happened with Peter Preston's Guardian either. But Alistair said to me, okay, it's still yours. And he let me go back to Washington. So I went back in 72. And I was there during Nixon.
Were you there when Nixon went to China?
I was there, but I didn't go with him.
Did it make a big impact there?
Actually, I'm not even sure if I've... You know, I can't remember what year he went to China. I'm not sure
72.
That... 72. But I went to... I went to Russia with him in 72, and I went to Russia with him again in 74, just before his demise. But I certainly didn't go to China with him.
Could you tell me about the Russian visits with Richard Nixon? That must
actually,
have been
really I'm not even being truthful. I went with him in 74. That was the first time I went. No, in 72, I think he had already been to Russia. Anyway, I was only just getting back to Washington. I didn't go with him. But in 74, I went, and that, of course, was the trip where he tried to somehow get Brezhnev to prop him up domestically. And Brezhnev, by that time, realized that. That didn't make too much sense. Even if he could have done something, I mean, he was not prepared to do anything for Nixon. But I remember, you know, we went with Kissinger, and we all had, I mean, apart from anything else, I remember it because we had a huge problem because. A lot of us flew in with Nixon, but were not going to fly back with Nixon because a lot of us were going to stay on in Europe afterwards for a few days. Excuse me. And Russian bureaucracy being what it is, as we came in on the White House plane, you know, we didn't have any of the kind of formalities and the passport stamping and so on and so forth that you get when you arrive individually. The problem was what were they going to do? How were we going to be able to leave without having the necessary paperwork in our passports? And, you know, this caused huge headaches for the Americans, who somehow had to arrange it that something was put into our passports or we were given pieces of papers that allowed us to leave the country afterwards. You know, I remember chiefly on the one hand, Kissinger trying to be upbeat. I remember he gave a huge press conference quite late at night in the nightclub of the hotel where we were staying. You know, he was trying to gloss over everything that was happening. And, of course, they did sign the SALT agreement, I think, if I remember rightly, during that trip. And he tried to put a very positive gloss on U.S.-Soviet relations and tried to paint a very positive picture of Nixon's international stature. And then we flew to Yalta, where Nixon and Brezhnev met again, and it was fascinating being there. But the Americans would not allow us to, they asked us not to use Yalta as a byline. They wanted us to use Oriana, where our hotel was, just because of the associations with Yalta. They didn't want to draw attention to the fact that Nixon was in Yalta. But I remember it's a very scenically, very beautiful, very sort of Mediterranean type countryside. And then from there, we flew to Minsk in Dino, Russia. And I was in the White House press plane, with really the absolute creme de la creme. I mean, all the top American journalists were in that plane. And it was a beautiful day, blue skies, and suddenly our plane dropped from high up to considerably lower down. And, you know, just sudden like that. And then it flew on. And, I mean, you know, we were all absolutely, totally petrified. We had Secret Service on the plane. Nobody said anything. And we did land in Minsk. And as we got off, the Secret Service sort of whispered to us, we dropped an engine. And the next day we were flying, because the Russians would not allow the Americans to use their own planes on over Russian territories, over Soviet territory. I think even Nixon had to fly in a Soviet plane. And the next day we were flying back to Moscow, and we were apparently still in the same plane that had dropped the engine the day before. Anyway, as you can see, we all survived. But at the time, we thought, you know, in one fell swoop, he would have had the, you know, the cream of American journalism all together in one plane. So, and then, you know, all of us wrote the same story, saying, you know, how hard Nixon had tried to appear to be relaxed, wholly absorbed by foreign policy issues, successfully received in the Soviet Union, instead of which, of course, he flew back into the biggest crisis of his life. And
what was your impression of him, Nixon? You must have seen quite a lot of him, you know, on a trip like that.
Well, I think, you know, I have to say the same thing that I've said again about other people whom I haven't known personally very closely, that I find it very hard to disentangle my personal impressions of them in this casual kind of way that one notices people at press conferences and things like that. And what you read about them, you know, I think in retrospect, I think much better of Nixon's foreign policy than I thought at the time, because partly I saw him very much as a cold warrior, but also because, you know, I saw what was happening domestically. To the extent that one can be a bit more detached about him in retrospect, I think you have to recognize that in terms of East-West relations, and of course the relationship with China, he was constructive. You know, if you think back, he was the one who promoted the ABM treaty, which the Bush administration is going to do its best to abrogate, and that has been one of the treaties which has really been a very important factor in arms control. And again, it was Nixon who first promoted the idea of limits to strategic nuclear weapons, and who didn't use the... I mean, Nixon, to my mind, didn't see the arms race as a way of undermining the Soviet economy in the way that Reagan used the arms issue later. I think that Nixon was genuinely concerned to limit the arms race, if not to reverse it, but certainly not to accelerate it. Now, how much of this was Nixon and how much of it was Kissinger? I think the historians will go on debating this for a very long time to come.